Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Senate Social Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. We're meeting in the Budget Fiction Room in 205 in the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones out of courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Hughes, and Senator Begich. We do have a quorum to conduct business. This afternoon, we have one item of business. That is a continuation of SB 124, the mental health facility meds. Available for committee members for questions as we finish up the amendment process, hopefully today, is Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor from the Department of Health and Human Services. We have Mr. Steve Williams, the CEO of the Mental Health Trust Authority, Mr. Steve Bookman, Stephen Bookman, the Senior Assistant Attorney from the Department of Law, and we have Ms. Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. And also representing DPS, we have Deputy Commissioner Lael Morgan here in the room for our safety and protection.
Leon.
We will now continue with the amendment process. We are on Amendment 15 for those folks following along at home. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment 15.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So basically what this does is on page 10, line 7, it basically just deletes it basically includes the 72 hours includes transportation time as well, because it's a lot of time for the patient to be in an unknown situation. So the time just includes transportation time. That's basically what the amendment does.
All right. And this amendment starts where?
Where
you
does
just
it
give
start?
A general...
Oh, I'm sorry. Page 10, line 7.
And the...
Just the 72 hours includes transportation time as well. It's basically...
That's what... not... Page 10 is not...
Mine is at the bottom. Right over there. That's really where the big part is. We just... It just includes transportation time.
All right. Any... questions?
What does she mean, transportation time? I need a broader...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Senator Reinbold, can you give a little bit more description of transportation time, of when does it start? Is it transportation from the moment that the person is picked up or dropped off or transferring to one facility to another facility?
Okay, so if we go... So I think everybody just needs to go to page 6 in the bill, if you guys have the bill in front of you.
Page 6...
Yeah, page 6, line 5. So basically, page 6, line 5, and I'll just start reading. Computation of the 72-hour period at a crisis residential center before a hearing does not include Saturdays, Sundays, legal holidays. And then it says the hearing shall be held in a crisis residential center. And it goes on to basically that 72 hours is what I'm saying that includes the travel time. As well, not just because they're closed. It includes the time it takes to get the patient to this facility.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Begich.
Thank you. I have a couple of issues with this. Back when I was in the juvenile justice system, one of the things that was part of our calculation with holds was, do we have enough adequate time to provide, you know, sort of counseling, that kind of thing during a period of time? Am I correct? I believe that the API time is 72 hours for the full evaluation, because that's the time that we perceive as being the time period that that's what a clinical psychologist would need. That would be their opportune amount of time. And what this would do would be effectively changing the standards. So if you're admitted to API, you'd get the full 72 hours for an eval. Under this, getting rid of those considerations, the issue you had with juvenile justice was you could get a kid arrested, say, or picked up in Queeclick. If you did a 72-hour hold but you couldn't get a flight out for 2 days, you'd end up basically having no time for clinical review under this amendment. So there's technically it could actually limit the service to the patient, which is that full evaluation that you want to do with the patient. I believe that your intent is to make sure that they're just not trapped in the netherworld of nothingness.
Basically.
But what this could do is actually impair the patient in the process. And so that's my concern with that. And just a technical, there's a technical error too. Just you wrote at the bottom of the amendment the words treatment facility. I think you mean crisis. That was, I think, supposed to be the crisis residential center. But that's minor. The bigger issue is I don't think it's, I think the intent of what you want to do is not reflected in this, and it could actually be of harm to the patient. I know that's not your intent. So.
Senator Ramble.
Okay, so basically, it just, if there's, it says, a computation of the 72-hour period of crisis entered before hearing does not include Saturdays, Sundays, weekends, legal holidays. So we're inserting it, the computation of a 72 evaluation period under AS 4730708 includes any period of time necessary to transport the patient to the treatment facility. It goes on to talk about by a contemporaneous two-way video conference, by teleconference, all this kind of stuff. So I guess I'm trying to figure out why 72 hours is not enough. It just seems like enough to, that it can include the transportation time to me. So I don't know why you have a problem with that.
Yes, and then we'll go to Senator Hughes.
The 72 hours is the time period that's necessary for the actual clinical interaction there. That's why, because that's the same as what we do when we admit somebody to API. We give them that 72 hours with the clinician to determine really what are the best resources and services we want to provide the patient. And so by throwing in the transportation time, throwing in the Sundays and Saturdays, you may end up providing no clinical face time for the patient. And I don't think that's your intent. I think you want to have that interaction. That's when the assessment's done. And that's when the assessment determines best placement and works with the patient. And
Senator Hughes.
So I understand this correctly. This is including the travel time from when the law enforcement officer picks up the person and takes them to the center. Is that correct?
It says, when under this section the court grants an application to admit the respondent within the crisis center, the court shall set a time for the hearing to be held within 72 hours after the respondent's arrival at the crisis stabilization center.
I understand that. I want to know, Mr. Chair, if the travel time, the transportation time that you're envisioning that you want to exclude is from the moment that law enforcement officer picks up the patient and takes them to the center. Is that the time you're trying to exclude? Or are you trying to exclude time from the center to the hearing? Because I don't think there is going to be travel to the hearing. It's going to be done on site. So are you referring to the time the officer picks up the patient and takes them to the center?
Senator Reinbold.
So page 6, line 5, where it says does not include, this would just delete that and say includes. I mean, that pretty much answers everybody's questions.
So to answer that question, yes, Senator Hughes, that would include the transportation time of any type of law enforcement, DMS, or any type of other transportation type of time frame from
okay, then
start that clock.
And so that begs a question, Mr. Chair. I don't know who would be best to answer it. I picture in Anchorage or Palmer, Eagle River, that it might just be 30 minutes, and that would be negligible, no big deal. But would there be cases where it, in a village, for instance, if weather is bad, that they could be stuck in the village for, 38 hours or something? I just want to know what kind of time we are talking about.
We'll call up our two experts to answer that deal with transportation. One deputy commissioner, Larry New, getting up, and Ms. Carpenter. And whoever would like to start first?
I can. Through the chair, Leon Morgan, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. Senator Hughes, I believe your question is how long does it take us to transport someone to a crisis stabilization center? I'll give you an example of our current Title 47 structure today, which would be, I think, equitable to this question. You're absolutely correct. In an area of urbanized Alaska, whether it's Fairbanks down to the rail belt, we're looking at transport time. But anywhere out west, anywhere in southeast, even our more rural areas off the road system up in the we call the Rich Alcan District, up in Tow, 40-mile country, it's going to be going to be dependent. It's a priority to get folks that we take under mental health hold into the proper facilities. We do not want to incarcerate these folks, but we don't have the facilities in those areas. And so we make it a priority to get them to the, in this case, Crisis Stabilization Center, but it will not be immediate. It will most likely be, I would say, on average, a 24-hour period.
Ms. Carpenter, do you have anything that you'd like to add in terms of transportation?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. I would just agree with Deputy Commissioner Morgan. There are times where the department has to coordinate for secure transport from perhaps a rural location or someplace off the road system. Again, Southeast is a great example. We had a recent case in Southeast that was not in the Juneau community where a DET is, and it took us over 24 hours to get transportation. In this instance, if you're looking at perhaps us having a rural hospital that might set up a crisis residential center, say in Kotzebue, you might have to be coordinating a flight from somebody in region to get to Kotzebue to use one of these centers. So it really does go back to having the maximum amount of time of clinical assessment for the 72 hours.
And the acronym you use, DET?
Sorry, Designated Evaluation and Treatment Center.
Thank you. Right, any further questions?
I have a comment.
Yes, your comment, Senator Hughes and Senator Casella.
So Senator Reinbold's concern, I share it because if someone is delayed by weather a couple days, now we're talking 5 days, and that seems to be an infringement on that person. And I would hope that even though the contact time with the patient would be limited, that they should still stick to that and that the court would, you know, be ready to go, and that the providers, that there could be teleconferencing, counseling with that person while they're stuck in the bad weather, that kind of thing. I really don't like the idea of somebody being held 5 or 6 days. Do you have a suggestion of how we could address this? Because I don't think it's right for rural residents to be subject to all that extra time.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, again, this is Heather Carpenter, DHSS. You are right that we try to, you know, do telehealth where we can, but sometimes, you know, it's not set up for certain locations or they don't have the right personnel. In a case where somebody cannot be transported, per our settlement with the Disability Law Center, the department actually has to go in and do a reevaluation to see if that person still meets criteria after 48 hours. It is rare that we have to do that because we're able to make transportation happen before then. But it can be difficult to make that transportation happen, you know, less than 24 hours. Or you're getting close to 24 hours by the time that person is transported on the flight and arrives to that facility.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
This is really important. And having lived in rural Alaska and having been stuck due to weather, I appreciate it. We have primary care clinics in virtually every village or within a close range. And with telehealth, and if a person were to be held in that primary care clinic, I think you could begin the services. It's not like being at the center, but it could still begin. What could that not be part of the treatment at the center so that we can not put our rural residents in an unfair situation of being having to wait extra days beyond urban residents?
I will start that answer before giving it to the department. There is a billing disparity in telehealth, and so a lot of folks, we have a piece of legislation in this committee that we're seeking to fix that situation with some of the payment issues. And so without having payment, a lot of providers want to offer those services just for the benefit of the community without being able to be reimbursed for them is what our office has heard. And I'll let Ms. Carpenter add or distract from that.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think it's going to depend on which location the individual is ordered to. So API does not, you know, currently just talking about what we have now, not all of these patients are going to be transported just to API. We are going to use our three hospitals that are designated evaluation and treatment center hospitals, which are Fairbanks Memorial, Matsu Regional, and Bartlett Hospital. So it will depend on if each of those has telehealth capabilities set up in our willing to start doing that. I would have to reach out to each of the hospitals to communicate with them, but I think we hear you, and the department is constantly looking at how we can expand telehealth capabilities. And again, doing those reevaluations is one piece to make sure that a patient is not just waiting and floundering without, you know, any reassessment.
I know you need to move on to other people. I need to make a comment. This section is referring to the stabilization centers, not the hospitals. And if the centers are supposed to be conducting the hearings by two-way videos, they would be set up to have that. The primary care clinics throughout the state, part of the community health center system, have that capability. So I don't see any reason why once they are, the law enforcement officer has the person and gets them to that clinic, that treatment can't begin. So I am uncomfortable with allowing some residents of our state to be held for longer than 72 hours. And I haven't studied this enough to see if this how this would work. And I hear Senator Begich as far as person needs doesn't want to be shortchanged on the treatment, but I believe that it could begin in the rural setting.
Senator Casella.
Thank you. So in the second portion of the bill that where it deletes the two references to the statute and inserts the 4737.15, that's a procedure after order, and it just simply states that an evaluation period not to exceed 72 hours, and it doesn't even, and it actually deletes the new statute created in this bill, which would be 4737.08. So my question is for the sponsor, did you mean to exclude the crisis evaluation centers in that second portion of the amendment?
Through the chair?
Yes,
So basically, I'm going to go back and circle back at a very high level that what I'm concerned about is, let's just say, like, I lost a crown on a Friday. Then they're closed on Saturday, they're closed on Sunday, and then Monday's a legal holiday. So, you know, that's four long days. Well, then they get another 72 hours because everyone was on vacation. And so then they get 72 more hours. So that's, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So now we're potentially dealing with it on Friday. I just don't think it's fair to the patient. And I think that's where my issue is, why people are out celebrating July 4th or whatever. They're being trapped. And I just think anything we can do to get them help as quickly as we can. And both of these two that testified basically said 24 hours is a good amount of time to transport people, even from West Alaska. I just feel like this is a really reasonable amendment.
Comment?
Yes, Senator Casella.
Thank you. And I understand where the drafter is coming from. And I actually am looking at the statute, and it excludes Saturdays, Sundays, and legal holidays. And I'm thinking, to me, that doesn't seem right, that if you rush a person to a center and it happens to be a Saturday or a Sunday or a legal holiday, they have to wait. I get that. But this is an amendment that actually changes statute, and I'm asking about line 5, 6, and 7 in the amendment. I'm looking at the statute, and it's deleting the new portion that deals with the detention at a crisis residential center. So I would like maybe the drafter of the amendment to come forward, because if this passes, then we're saying that you aren't taking somebody to a crisis residential center. I mean, there can be what people want in an amendment and then what the amendment actually does. So yes,
let's get Mr. Bookman, Department of Law.
Would it be Ambrose?
I'm not sure, but I think we'll ask our Department of Law individual to speak to this. Did you hear Senator Casella's question on page on the amendment dealing with line 5 through line 7 on amendment number 15?
Yes. For the record, I'm Stephen Bookman with the Department of Law, and through the chair, I think Senator Costello's concerns are right on. I think they're correct. It doesn't make sense to separate out the new facilities from the existing facilities.
Can I suggest that we table this amendment just to clear it up, because so that it reflects the sponsor would like to do?
At this time, we've had multiple days on these amendments and weeks. This bill has two more committees of referral on the floor as well to fix some of these issues, and I feel that that's enough time to work through what we have in front of us and continue on with this piece of item and this piece of legislation.
Could I ask
Senator Casella.
Thank you. So currently, if somebody is brought in for an evaluation and it's a Saturday, Sunday, or holiday, does that person have to wait until that Saturday, Sunday, or holiday is over before the 72 hours starts?
Ms. Carpenter.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS, I think Mr. Bookman would be the best person to address this question.
Mr. Bookman.
Yes, through the chair, and for the record, again, I'm Stephen Bookman with the Department of Law, and again, the senator is correct. The time would start on the first minute of Monday.
With that, I share Senator Begich's concern in terms of getting health professionals the adequate time to serve that opportunity. Senator Reinbold, closing remarks before we vote on this amendment.
Okay, so the intent of this amendment would be, regardless of the facility, because I think that's what Senator Casella was concerned about. I think she was concerned about AS 4730.708. Basically, what this is in regards to is just to get the patients is in to see within 72 hours, including transportation time. So that is the intent of this amendment.
All right. With that, I will maintain my objection.
Mr.
Chair. At ease. All right. Back in the record, we're going to take a vote at this time on amendment number 16. 15. 1-5.
No.
Senator Hughes?
No.
Senator Costello?
No.
Senator Reinbold?
Yes.
Senator Wilson?
No. One yay and four nays, amendment number 15 fails. We're on to number 16.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I'd just like to make a quick comment that I am very concerned about the people in the rural areas being held, and I want to work on this in the judiciary, so I just want to make it clear, because you could actually have someone held for weather a couple days, come in, hit a weekend, and then three more days. It could end up being like 8 days. So we do need to work on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. We are now on to amendment number 16. Right, Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 16.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So some of the experts that we've been working with have said this is a very, very important amendment. This is on page 5, line 7. It says, insert a new subsection. The examination under A of the section must include an evaluation whether the respondent is suffering from a medical-induced psychosis or psychosis caused by drug withdrawal, the mental health professional shall consult with a qualified medical personnel to address any findings. So I move amendment 16. If I didn't do that, I'm sorry.
All right, Senator Begich.
Just a quick question. When you say qualified medical personnel, just for the record, what are you talking about there? What does that mean? Is it just a person with a MD, a person with a... APRN, is an RN? Just a question. I just want to be sure. I get it.
And I think that to clarify that for Senator Begich, I don't think there's a definition for qualified medical personnel in this language. Senator Reinbold.
So with that, I know we addressed that on later amendments. You know, if we're going to have the public health person, a mental health specialist, I personally, my personal preference is people that are licensed with a psychiatrist or a psychologist, or a PA or a physician, you know, that's my, but I address that later on in other amendments.
Yes, Senator Casella.
Thank you, and I guess this is for the department. Doesn't this happen anyway, and isn't this the whole point of the evaluation?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, you are correct that the medical personnel, including the mental health professionals on site at these locations, would assess for exactly what this amendment is asking.
There should be no problem with it, right? So there should be no problem with that. Because what the bottom, I think it's just really important if someone is coming out of withdrawal from a drug or it's induced because of a medication, I just think that's a, the psychiatrist that I've been working with and the health, the mental health advocates thought this was very, very, very important for them to be able to discriminate between these two things, and so the patient would get the proper care. So if there's no problem, then the amendment should pass easily.
I think it's with the redundancy of what a medical qualified individual would consist of, is that there is no definition of that here in this bill or maybe in statute.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Rebel.
The mental health professional, I think, is pretty obvious. The person who's treating the patient or a qualified medical personnel to address any findings. I mean, we could literally go through every single word, but I think it's important that we know whether it's in medically induced or whether it's from a drug withdrawal. I don't think this is an issue
seconds.
We're fighting over.
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Just a quick question. We've established it's redundant. Does it cause a harm?
Through the chair, Senator Begich. I think the last on lines 5 and 6 where it says shall consult with qualified medical personnel does offer some confusion because there's no definition for what qualified medical personnel is. And we, you know, believe that the mental health professional is that qualified medical personnel.
Thank you.
Yes.
Can it be that then? I mean, because to me, I mean, the mental health professional shall consult with qualified medical personnel. I mean, the more we add, I mean, if you're asking for a definition, I don't think it's necessary personally because it gives a little bit of flexibility there. The whole point of the issue is to see what was the cause, whether it's a withdrawal or if it's induced.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I'm a little confused at your question, and I apologize for that, because if we're considering the mental health professional to be that qualified personnel we're asking them to consult, it almost would read with themselves. And I think without a definition, then the department would have to define that in regulation or at least, you know, put something, and there wouldn't be a statutory definition to tie back to.
Senator Reinbold.
So I see exactly. So you're talking about the examination. So there's an examination, you know, by X, Y, and Z. They have to decide where it's going, kind of like triage, basically. And then the mental health professional that did the examination will consult with a qualified person, a medical personnel, to address any findings, exactly like you would do in an emergency room situation where the emergency room doctor basically saw somebody and then didn't have potentially the expertise, and so they had to reach out to someone with a little bit higher expertise to get some consultation. Again, this is just an amendment that protects the patient, and that's my ultimate goal with every single one of these amendments, is to keep the patient in mind.
I think that the issue could be is that you could have a dual individual who has a medical expertise and a mental health expertise, like a licensed psychiatrist who is both, who is an MD, but also has a mental health experience. And so who would they consult with would be the issue. Would they consult with their medical half, or would they consult with their behavioral health half on that side?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to put it back on you. Who's doing the examination? I'm trying to remember who exactly has the legal ability to do the examination. Right now, do you know, or maybe Heather knows?
I believe it's that definition of, please, if you can find it faster than I can, Ms. Carpenter, please answer.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, it is the mental health professional who will do the evaluation, and that is defined in your definition handout that I had previously given the department. So it's AS 4730, 915, 13. and it means a psychiatrist or physician who's licensed by the state medical board, a clinical psychologist, a psychological associate trained in clinical psychology. Sorry, I'm trying to skip through so I don't read every word. Advanced practice registered nurse or a registered nurse with a master's degree in psychiatric nursing, a marital and family therapist, a professional counselor, a clinical social worker, and a person who has a master's degree in the field of mental health, has at least 12 months of post-master's working experience in the field of mental illness, and is working under the supervision of a type of licensee listed in the paragraph.
Senator Ramble.
So the bottom line is you have a problem with this amendment because of the mental health professional shall consult with somebody and get some advices. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, as that those lines are drafted on line 5 and 6 with the qualifier that it says shall consult with qualified medical personnel because that is not defined anywhere.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
So basically, I'm just frustrated as heck because, I mean, this is where we're going down rabbit holes. It just said the examination of the section must include an evaluation of the respondent who whether they're suffering from this or this. And this profession, it says the mental health professional shall consult with medical personnel to address findings. I guess I'm just blown away that you have problems, you know, having somebody with a specialty in possibly drug withdrawals or a side effect from a medication-induced psychosis. A lot of people might not have that expertise. So I'm really struggling why. When the healthcare professionals and the psychiatrists and the people who are dealing with psych rights like Jim Gottstein, Faith, Kat, all these people that we've been working the last year and a half with, I guess I'm flabbergasted that we wouldn't want to be able to discern this and get someone that actually has some expertise in this area. Once again, I'm looking out for the patients and deferring to experts. This is far over my head. I'm dealing with people. They flagged a couple of my amendments as critically important. This was one of them.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, so it's standard procedure that this already happens, that the determination is made during the exam whether this is from medication-induced psychosis or psychosis caused by drug withdrawal. So that already happens.
Where does that happen?
They said on the record that's standard procedure, that already happens. So and then we just learned by the providers that Heather just listed that we have often physicians, psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, PAs, et cetera, doing this. So are they consulting with themselves? I mean, that's kind of odd. So my question is, of those lists of providers, some of them don't have prescribing authority. They have it's very mental health focused as opposed to medical focused. A counselor that's got a master's or whatever you read, would that person be in touch with medical providers as a standard part of this process?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, you are correct. They would be in touch with other medical personnel. Additionally, they would be in touch with the professional person in charge, which is also in the definitions of this part of statute. And that means the senior mental health professional at a facility or that person's designee. In the absence of a mental health professional, it means the chief of staff or a physician designated by the chief of staff.
And Mr. Chair, for that reason, since all of this is already standard, already happening, I'd like to call the question.
Can I ask one question?
Question to be called. Do you have final wrap-up, Senator?
Well, my bottom line is I can't – can you, Senator Hughes, tell me exactly where it says in statute already that this is already – part of the law because the mental health expert said this is of critical importance to them, and I couldn't find it anywhere in statute right now. So I don't know that this actually happens just because of hearsay. Just because somebody says it happens doesn't mean it happens. This actually ensures that it protects the patients.
I think we've already went through that explanation.
And I'll just say really quickly, Mr. Chair, when it's standard practice, best practices, if a provider is not doing that, those are the kind of things they can lose their license over, so I'm comfortable that this is happening. And so I'd like to call the
yes. With that, we'll take a roll call vote for amendment number 16.
No.
No.
Senator
Yes.
No.
No. With one yay and four nays, Amendment Number 16 fails. Moves us to Amendment Number 17. Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment Number 17.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So basically, what this does is it's page 8, line 9, following AS 47.30.838 to insert, and only if the Crisis Stabilization Center or Crisis Resolution Center ascertains the date the respondent last underwent a physical exam, administers the psychotropic medicines as only as a last resort, and conducts an examination based on the checklist developed by the department to exclude commonly known issues that may contribute to conditions and symptoms that mimic the psychiatric disorder. So this just helps get laser focus in regards to what the exact issue is, and that they hold off and try to do the most natural interventions and use the psychotropic medications at the last resort so they are not abused.
I'll start. Senator Reinbold, I think that this goes to another conversation we had, another amendment, about that this is sort of a medications that would happen as a crisis situation that would be immediate harm to self or others. And the time it would take to ascertain the last physical examination under the line of questioning, you may not have someone that is able to give that information or have that information. This is not for more of a residential type of treatment center. I think that goes to your first number one on line three. Line five, I think that already happens. And sort of similar to line six on your bullet three, I think this is something that is already done under conditions when new medications are out. But this is, again, just for crisis situations where it is only for those life and death situations. We're not giving any medications that would be on an ongoing or starting that treatment without the patient's consent to that. The patient would have to be notified of all those other side effects and other additional informations if they were to be prescribed long-lasting medications. But for this, just for the emergent medications, it's something that I feel that's already taken care of.
Can I respond?
Yeah, of course, Senator Reinbold.
Oh, okay. So basically what my concern is, and maybe it's too much when I was working in my in medical area, but I think it's really, really good to know someone's physical history. You usually get charged a lot more, and they spend a lot more time. What are all your previous conditions? What are your medications that you're on, et cetera? So you know the drug-drug interactions. You know that about the patient. I think it's super important to have that as a baseline. And then just encouraging them or administering the psychotropic drugs as only as a last resort, I think is of critical importance. These could have, like all those side effects that I listed, there's serious side effects from many psychotropic drugs. And so it could potentially cause harm to the patient or even put them in a worse state. So I think encouraging them as a last state or administering them as a last state is very, very important. And I think having a checklist to make sure that these things are checked, because the problem here is some other conditions can mimic psychiatric disorders. So this is what was another one flagged, you know, by the physicians and the patient advocates. It's a very important issue to help protect the patient rights. And that's why, you know, to me, this amendment is really important. It's one of about a half a dozen of them that got flagged as of critical importance to people that know far more about this issue than I do. And this was an amendment that they thought was incredibly important. And Faith Myers wanted her letter at this point to be read in. And so I'd ask permission, Mr. Chairman, to have Faith's letter, read into the record, because that's what she asked me to do, you know, at this time.
Senator Reinbold, that letter is and uploaded in basis for folks to follow and to read. And just for the time of that, make sure we have enough time to get through the rest of the amendments here. That we're going to say no to reading that whole letter into a record, that people can go to basis under the committee and find that letter that's dated the 13th of March. Mm-hmm. Is that the letter?
It's on basis.
Yes. Senator Casella.
Thank you. And again, just to state that when we vote on an amendment, we're voting on the entire amendment and what it actually does. I like what happens in this amendment on lines 6, 7, and 8, but the way this amendment is written, the Crisis Residential Center cannot help the individual unless they determine the date they last underwent a physical examination. I cannot tell you the last time I had a physical examination. I can't tell you the month and the day. So I'm concerned that the way this amendment is written, it's going to stop the care from happening with the individuals that we're addressing in this situation.
Thank you. Senator Hayes.
Senator who?
Hughes.
You're saying it in a funny way. So I'm picturing the man with a heart attack on the table, and they have to be able to save his life to quickly administer medications. They don't have time to find out their last physical exam. They don't have time to go through a checklist to see if they were eating healthy and getting their cholesterol checked, et cetera. They have to administer the medication to save the man's life. In this situation, in the center, a person could be having an extreme episode, beating their head on a glass window, breaking it, their head being cut, and they're continuing to try to bang their head on that window. We have to be able to save their life. We don't have time to find out when their last physical exam, and then Senator Costello mentioned that might be difficult. And so this is for emergency extreme conditions. And for the other care, this makes sense, but not for these life-death situations. So I won't be supporting the amendment.
I close that, Senator Hughes. Sorry, Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so just so you guys are very clear, this amendment is on page 8, line 9. And page 8, line 9 is a crisis stabilization center or crisis residential center may administer psychotropic medications to an involuntarily held or detained respondent only under a manner that is consistent with AS 4730838. This is where I'm inserting this. So in that little area right there, first you got to know the history, because if you administer this and maybe they're going to have a side effect, and maybe it's my 10 or so years with Big Pharma that's caused me to be extraordinarily concerned about drug interactions. You claim that you're going to try to save this person's life, but yet you're going to give them something that potentially could have a massive drug interaction and potentially cause death. So to me, knowing their medical history is of critically importance. Even if you guys insisted on taking that out, I still think it's critical to say administer the psychotropic medications only as a last resort and conducts an examination based on a checklist to exclude commonly known issues that contribute to conditions and symptoms that mimic psychiatric disorder. So I guess you guys are really pro, you know, injecting people with psychotropic medication.
I object.
I just want
to. That is not germane to this topic.
That's impugning. So at this time, we'll take the vote on amendment number 17.
No.
Yes.
No.
No.
No. With one yay and four nays, amendment number 17 fails. Senator Reinbold, I think amendment number 18 was identical to amendment number 5, which you co-sponsored and passed.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. So I will withdraw amendment number 18.
Okay. Brings us to amendment number 19. Senator Reinbold.
So I move amendment number 19.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So basically what this does – and first of all, if I could clarify something on the other.
No, we're on amendment number 19, Senator Reinbold.
I just think it's totally unfair in regards to just using a patient banging their head on a glass. No one would allow that to happen. So to me, that was impugning my motive.
We're on amendment number 19, Senator Reinbold.
So what this does is it deletes the professional in charge and it inserts the physician license to practice in this state. So to me, that's very, very important to ensure that someone who is licensed is actually doing the care instead of just somebody in charge.
I think that this would limit those number of medical professionals, and we don't have that number of medical professionals in our state, and it would be a little bit more restrictive to the amount of care that we could offer in detention centers. And we would get rid of that definition that was read into the record earlier by Ms. Carpenter, those mid-level professionals, which a lot of centers currently utilize in our state to help meet our need of licensed providers in our state. Yes, Senator Reibel.
Okay. Yeah, so basically, Section 13 is a new section, 473707, admission to hold at a crisis stabilization center, except as provided by B of this section, and it goes on to the respondent in 473705. The crisis stabilization center may hold the respondent at the center for a period not to exceed 23 hours and 49 minutes. A mental health professional shall examine the respondents within 3 hours. And so there's the mental health, professional thing that they had an issue with the definition before, but it's here. But this, what this does is it addresses on line 29. So the next area, it says, if the professional or person in charge of the crisis stable session determines there's probable cause to believe that respondent is acute healthcare crisis, dot, 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 dot. What this does is instead of putting a person in charge, it actually has someone who's licensed, who actually understands this area of expertise and mental health. I mean, detaining someone involuntarily is a big, big deal. So you don't just want someone in charge. I think a physician that's licensed to practice in the state is of critical importance. So they're actually getting medical care and not just whoever happens to be in charge at that time.
Well, before we go to Senator Begich, I think that this having a physician license would get rid of our licensed advanced nurse practitioners that practice psychiatric medicine. Senator Begich.
Thank you. Just to clarify with perhaps Mr. Bookman, there is a definition. We just discussed this, but there is a definition for professional person in charge in statute, isn't there?
For the record, I'm Stephen Bookman with the Department of Law. There is a definition of professional person in charge at AS 4730915. Paragraph 17.
Can you give us a brief?
Yes. The professional person in charge means the senior mental health professional at a facility or that person's designee. In the absence of a mental health professional, it means the chief of staff or a physician designated by the chief of staff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Through the
chair. Yes, Senator Reinbold.
So it's not necessarily a physician or a medical. Is that correct? I mean, am I interpreting that correctly? The chief of staff.
It would be a phys. Through the chair, Senator, the chief of staff is a term of art that's not addressed in these statutes. The chief of staff is chief of the medical staff, and there are federal regulations on who can be the chief of the medical staff. I frankly do not have them in front of me. I believe that person has to be a physician, but I would have to follow up with you on that. I don't believe it's defined in Alaska statute.
Senator Ramble.
So to me, then this would complement what I believe you are saying when it says the professional person in charge. If the professional person in charge needs to be, is the chief of staff and the chief of staff is licensed, then this should complement what you're trying to do. It rather than it just be a term of art or whatever you said. That this actually ensures that it is a true physician. I mean, because like I said, I mean, holding people against their will and administering psychotropic drugs is a big, big deal. So that's why I mean, at minimum, I would think that you would want a physician here. So I just don't see why actually putting it in here is not what something that you guys would support. But I guess, go ahead.
All right. Did you want me to respond, or?
No, you're fine, Mr. Buckman. Senator Hughes.
Yes, because there, I actually know of one person who is a PA who specializes in mental health. And I would rather have that person making the call here than an OBGYN doctor, ear, nose, and throat doctor. So I am not comfortable with just allowing physicians. We have a shortage of physicians in our state. They're involved in other types of practices. And so I think it's better to stick with the folks that are very familiar with mental health care.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Final wrap up, Senator.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think she's confused about a hospital. This is on page 4, line 29. It says that this is talking about the professional person in charge at the crisis stabilization center. I don't think an OBGYN would be in charge there. So I think it's important that licensed physicians are actually in charge in regards to making these big decisions like holding someone without their will or giving them psychotropic drugs. So I just think it's really important, but I kind of see where this is going.
All right. With that closing remark, thank you, Senator Reinbold. We are going to take a vote on Amendment Number 19.
Pass.
Senator Hughes?
No.
Senator
Costello?
No. Senator
Reinbold?
Yes.
I'm going to say no.
No. One yay and four nays. Amendment number 19 fails.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Senator Baggage.
There is an ambiguity that Senator Reinbold has brought up here that needs to be addressed, and I hope that it is addressed in the next committee of referral.
Yes. Yes, Senator Casella.
Thank you for this indulgence in this comment. If you continue reading that section, the professional is working with the individual Alaskan, and if they don't voluntarily want to go to a crisis residential center, a mental health professional may submit an ex parte application to the court. And so there is oversight in this situation, and if all you have to do is continue to go on. And so I understand the concerns here, but I do think that if you were to read the actual statute, there's definitely oversight, and there is a mental health professional who is involved in this action.
All right. That brings us to Amendment Number 20, Senator Reinbold.
I skipped one. Hold on. I thought that was 20.
That was 19.
I thought that was – okay. Sorry. I'm a move Amendment Number 20.
I'll object, Senator Reinbold.
So basically, what it does is it on page 11, line 9 and 10, it deletes licensed under AS32 and then basically operated by the federal government. Basically what this does is the bill was, in my opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, was removing some sort of a licensing requirement in Title 47. And basically what I did is I reverted it back to original language, so they actually had to be licensed, not just operated by the federal government or run by the federal government, but it actually required licensure under 4732. If I'm incorrect in my interpretation, I hope someone will say, I just want it to require the licensure in the state and not yield any more power to the federal government. That was my intent.
Looks like Ms. Carpenter is ready to answer that question for you, Senator Reinbold.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, DHSS. Senator Reinbold, these locations would still need to be licensed because if you look further on in the bill, those are hospitals or crisis residential centers where we actually changed the definition of evaluation facility, are required to be licensed under 4732. The reason the department changed this definition is because it was too broad to include all of the facilities licensed under 4732. Because that would include assisted living homes, childcare facilities, hospice, freestanding birth centers, and other locations that would never have the staffing or the facility set up that would perform the mental health evaluations. So that's also why on page 11, lines 8 and 9, we specifically say that these are facilities that have been designated or operated by the department to perform the evaluations described in 4730-660 through 4739-15. And those are those 72-hour evaluations that we're talking about to be very precise. And the reason it's important to leave in operated by the federal government, because that would include our tribal facilities, or in the off chance that one of our military hospitals would want to do this. But it's really critically important to leave that in there so our tribal facilities can operate in this space.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Reinbold.
So they are, all of them have to already be licensed under 4732?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, yes. I will give a caveat that tribal facilities are a little bit different how they are licensed, which is why they have to be called out separately. But other hospitals, yes, and crisis residential centers will have to be licensed by the state.
Yeah.
Yes,
Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so basically, I want to make sure I understand this correctly. So you basically carved out an area so tribal facilities don't have to be licensed under the state. Is that the proper interpretation?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, no, I would not say that's the proper interpretation because of how federal law exists and the relationship that tribal facilities have with the federal government and how they're recognized through the Indian Health Services.
So one more time, the clarification. Yeah. So one more time, those do not have to be, because I'm getting mixed messages here. They don't have to be licensed under 4732. So
I think I can try to interpret what Ms. Carpenter is stating is that our tribal facilities are licensed under Indian Health Services, which is a separate licensing process that the feds take, and that this amendment would make it so that they could not qualify under this bill to provide crisis stabilization or crisis services under this piece of legislation.
No.
Through the chair, if Senator Reinbold's amendment passed, then our tribal partners would not be able to operate a crisis residential center that would serve as an evaluation facility.
Yes. Okay.
So you were correct.
Okay. Further conversation on amendment number 20.
Just ask her about tribal, how many tribal facilities there are. Because I'm trying to decide whether to withdraw this amendment
hospitals?
Or not. I don't know, because I just, this is just.
Subregional clinics?
My amendment just reverted back to the original language that removed federal government and included only those licensed other states. I was just looking at, for state sovereignty issues and following state statute issues, and that was where it was as a state legislator. That's what I was doing, is just protecting state sovereignty, protecting state rights, protecting the residents of the state. So I wasn't really getting into the federal. I was just trying to make sure that we were looking out for the state issue. So maybe I should withdraw this, but if you could provide any other clarification, I may be withdrawing this.
There's 8 sub-regional hospitals within the state, and Senator Hughes and I are guessing about maybe at least 130 or so clinics within the state of Alaska.
Tribally
owned facilities. Yes, yeah, Senator Reinbold.
With that, Mr. Chairman, this is not an area that I understand really, really well. I'm still learning, but with that, I'm going to go ahead and withdraw Amendment Number 20.
Okay. Amendment Number 20 is withdrawn. Amendment Number 21, Senator Reinbold.
I move Amendment Number 21.
I'll object, Senator Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment Number 21, and basically what this says, if you in several areas, it just takes out the word health officer, because like you guys were saying, a lot of things weren't defined. This actually was defined. So if you want to read the exact definition, it's on page 11, line 22 through 24. And it says health officer means a state, a municipal or other health officer. So to me, you know, that's super duper broad. A public health nurse, an emergency medical technician, a paramedic, a firefighter, or a person authorized under court to carry this out. To me, that just seemed extremely broad, and I really think it's important to have these people, especially they're in a pretty significant crisis, to not have so much broadness. And that's why we ended up requesting that be taken out.
Senator Baggage.
Thank you. As I recall, we extensively discussed this when we first heard the bill, or maybe second time we heard the bill, somewhere in there. We extensively discussed this very issue. It was made quite clear on the record that the health officer is a way of just clarifying definitions and cleaning up statute. And unless I'm mistaken, I just don't think that this amendment, with apologies to Senator Reinbold, I don't think it's necessary for the bill, given our very lengthy discussion of this. And maybe I would ask, just to clarify, am I remembering that correctly, Ms. Carpenter?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, you are correct that the term health officer came because in this CS we updated the definition of peace officer that's found on page 11, lines 12 through 17, to have a more common definition found in AS 0110.060A. So we take those items that are being deleted that don't fit in that definition of peace officer and created the new term health officer, and we added in there emergency medical technician, paramedic, and firefighter to address the individuals who are operating the mobile crisis teams like in Anchorage and Fairbanks and other locations.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter.
Further questions? Conversation on amendment number 21?
Mr. Chairman, if
None. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so I just want everyone to know that this is in section 22, so it's AS 473915. It's amended by adding a new paragraph. So this is under the new paragraph. A crisis residential center has the meaning of this. A crisis stable center has the meaning of this. And then the health officer. So this is important in regards to definitions. So this is just a very, very broad new area where I personally think it's far too broad. So I'm not going to withdraw this amendment because I feel like it's just too broad. I don't really think of a fireman or whatever should be called a health officer. So I want to keep this amendment, and I win, lose, or draw. I want to,
just so I understand.
Yeah, Senator Hughes.
Heather, did I understand you to say that sometimes on these intervention teams that are, you know, working to keep people out of the hospital, out of the jail, that are having an episode, that actually there are EMTs that are part of that team, or a paramedic that works for the fire department could be part of that team?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that is correct. For example, in Anchorage, the fire department is operating this, but I believe they are using paramedics as part of that team, and the department actually gave them a variance to operate their crisis mobile team so they could bill Medicaid to do so.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we will take a Senator Casella.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that I understand what this group of individuals will be doing. And from what I understand from reading the bill is that they are the individuals that may cause the person to be taken into custody. And then they will complete an application for examination of the person in custody and be interviewed by a mental health professional. So these are the individuals that are identifying that the individual is gravely disabled or suffering from mental illness and likely to cause serious harm to themselves or others, and then they are taking that individual to the Crisis Stabilization Center and then filling out the application or the forms, and then that individual, that Alaskan, will be reviewed by or seen by a mental health professional at that point. Is that all that they are doing?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, that is correct. So it's the items that you find in Section 11 of the bill that starts on page 3, lines 25, and continues on to the next page. So it's that initial protective hold.
Can you follow it?
Yes, Senator Casella.
And it's my understanding that health officer does not exist anywhere else in statute, and for the purposes of making this less wordy, we use that term and then define it at the end of the statute. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, that is correct.
All right. Senator Reinbold.
So I just want to make sure that people realize how broad, and, you know, with COVID and everything that's happened to COVID, and in my opinion, it's just been incredible and a brazen way to violate a lot of people's constitutional rights. I just think telling somebody that a health officer means a state, a municipal, or other health officer, a public health nurse, an EMT, paramedic, firefighters, or person authorized by the court, I mean, that is a huge group of people to be called health officers that can take people away, and you know, to me, it's a big deal. So I'm gonna keep the amendment here.
All right. With that, we'll take a roll call vote on amendment number 21. Sorry. Yes, amendment number 21. Roll call vote.
No.
Costello?
No.
Yes.
Senator Begich?
No.
No. With 4 nays, 1 yay, amendment number 21 fails. Brings us to amendment 22. Senator Reinbold.
I move amendment number 22.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So basically, what this one does is it deletes the health officer, medical professional, et cetera, in there, and then it inserts a physician's assistant or an assistant licensed by the state board to practice in this state, or a psychiatrist or a physician who is licensed to practice in the state, or a clinical psychologist licensed by the board or psychologist. I understand there could be issues with this in regards to, I didn't understand that the parentheses or employed by the federal government. I was just trying to, once again, preserve state control and state sovereignty in that area. So I understand that those on from 8 to 11, the parentheses or employed by the federal government. Now I know that means the tribal health, I believe. So that would be the only correction I would make to the amendment, is just removing the brackets on line 9 or employed by the federal government in this amendment. I know it's a conceptual amendment that you don't like here, but that would be the correction that I would do on this amendment.
I feel that these amendment 22 is similar to 19 and combining the previous amendment 21 on these things. Further discussion on amendment 22. Senator Casella.
Thank you. And I think just for the public listening, I think it's important to say not just what's being replaced, you know, with, because obviously somebody licensed by the state medical board sounds like a higher level person than the definition of health officer, but we're, again, I think when I read this and this amendment, this is the part where we're talking about the individual who can take the Alaskan to the crisis residential center, not the person at the crisis residential center who's administering anything. But again, we're talking about who can bring that individual. And what goes through my mind is that I think that it's more common that the definition of health officer will be the person who will come in contact with this individual, a firefighter, somebody who's out in the community dealing with people, not a physician assistant licensed by the state medical board. I don't think they're just out in the community. I think they're at the residential centers. That we're talking about who's bringing the Alaskan into the residential center, who is seeing that person having a psychotic episode. So I'm comfortable with that in the bill, and I'll be a no on this amendment.
Any other further debate on amendment 22? Seeing none, Senator Reinbold, your wrap up.
Okay, so basically what this does is it deals with page 3, line 26. That's where it starts, and this is a peace or health officer, which of course I was trying to delete the health officer part, or mental health professional or physician assistant licensed in the state. I think that if we're doing something so big as taking people, that people who actually are trained in this area need to be taking, you know, be the ones doing this. And basically what it says is it says who has probable cause to believe that that person is gravely disabled or suffering from a mental illness. And then it goes on and on, you know, in regards to the whole facility. I just believe that people that are trained in the area that know the practice of medicine, and not just a false accusation, oh, that person's mentally ill, whatever, that somebody that actually is trained in this needs to be involved. And that's why I think a physician's assistant or somebody that's licensed to practice by the medical board, I think that they need to play a role in these decisions. So that's why I think this amendment is important.
All right. With that, we'll add a roll call vote for amendment number 22.
No.
Reinbold?
Yes.
No.
No.
No. With a vote of 1 yay and 4 nays, amendment number 22 fails.
I'll be withdrawing this one.
Okay.
23 is the same as one.
Yeah.
Right.
Senator Reinbold, amendment 23.
So thank you. B.14, which is amendment number 3, is the same as Begich amendment number 1, which was B.29.
Begich Reinbold. Amendment, I think.
Yeah, there were several of those, but this is one of my earlier amendments. But with that, I will be withdrawing amendment number 23.
23 is withdrawn. Moves us now amendment number 24.
And this is my B.15. It was his B.31. 24 is the same as baggage amendment number 3, so I will be withdrawing that.
Same as baggage and Reinbold amendment number 3. Senator Reinbold, that moves us to amendment 25.
This one is kind of important to me. I want to withdraw this, but under one condition. I don't want to withdraw this, Mr. Chairman. We talked on page 5, line 25. It says, as a result, is likely to cause harm to self or others or is gravely disabled. We had this long discussion about serious. We decided not to put it in because of somebody something said on the record. And then I talked to, like, Jim Gottsy, we emailed back and forth, and he wrote a very extensive letter on why putting the word serious is in there. So I would withdraw with the one exception, if we can just add serious, is likely to cause serious harm to self or others in the amendment. And I think we kind of all came to that agreement anyway when we dealt with baggage amendment number 4. But with that, I'd like to know how to proceed in regards to this. Would like to withdraw, but with the exception of on amendment 4 that we add the word serious.
I think we already took that as a conceptual amendment, which failed already.
No. We did not. My recommendation is because there's been a lot of stuff happen, but I just know the word serious is really important in regards to this. I'd like to know what you guys' feelings. I know Jim Gottstein, this was very, very important. He actually apologized because he felt like this was that important of an issue to take up, to add the word cause serious harm to self or others.
Well,
if I could.
Yes, Senator Baggage.
We don't have an item on moved at this point, I don't think. But before we go there, maybe I think Mr. Bookman directly addressed the word serious and harm. And I thought we had it on the record in terms of both the last amendment and this amendment, the last one that you withdrew and this amendment, that and we did vote on it at that time, and the conceptual amendment failed. So I'm not sure. And you had, perhaps, Senator Hughes, you had indicated that this was something, I can't remember if this was the one that you had said that you would, okay. So perhaps if Mr. Bookman could comment on the use of the word serious, I would be appreciative of that.
Yes, Mr. Bookman, if you.
Yes, for the record, I'm Stephen Bookman, and through the chair, the Alaska Supreme Court has noted that in the existing statutes as they are now, sometimes the phrasing is serious harm to others, and sometimes the phrasing is harm to others, right? As it's written now, it's not consistent. And the Alaska Supreme Court has said that those definitions are essentially identical, that they should be read to inform each other. So that was the question, and that's my answer.
All right, Senator Reinbold.
So to me, I just think, you know, just causing harm to self or others, someone might misinterpret or not give it the seriousness of it. So I just think cause serious harm to self or others is very important. So I'm trying to figure out, is that what we understand it to be? I don't really want the court to be telling us, because someone might not read that court case. They're going to read the statute. And we're the policy setters, and that's why, you know, it's something about legislative supremacy that was my whole goal this entire session. That's why I want it defined in policy, and that's why this is very important to me on these amendments. When I was withdrawing, I just wanted to make sure that we got that on the record.
Yeah, I think that's what we did already through the amendment number 4 by Young Baggage, that they are indistinguishable in terms of usage of serious harm versus to cause harm to self and others.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes,
to both reassure Senator Reinbold and the committee, I mean, we have said that on the record now. We've actually requested now twice Department of Law has put that on the record. I'll say it again. I read, when I read harm there, I read serious harm, because that's how the court reads it. And that to me is the interpretation. So I'm comfortable with it as is, you know, in terms of the amendment we've already passed. Because I think it speaks to our concern as a group, as legislature, and as those who support the rights of those who are suffering psychosis or psychotic episodes, that when we talk about harm in this sentence, we are talking about serious harm. And believe me, on the record, that makes a difference.
Yes.
No one's going to go back and listen to this, and no one's going to go back to the court case. It's just the fact of the matter. I would say very few people are. And that's why I just don't see why, you know, we wouldn't put that word in just to make it clear, because we've got a whole bunch of snowflakes out there on both sides of the aisle and in the middle. And so it's just there's a lot of very hypersensitive people. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think putting the word in there, even very serious, is, I think, of crucial importance. I do.
Hold on. Senator Casella, then Senator Hughes. Senator Hughes.
This is for Mr. Bookman. Is the phrase, and I'm sorry because I was reading something else when you were talking previously. Is the phrase serious harm used anywhere else in statute?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm a little concerned about whether I'm the best person to answer that question. I have not done criminal law, and I think it might be done in criminal law. So maybe. I'm sorry, I can't give you a more definitive answer.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Sandra.
What I can do is, because if it's used somewhere as serious harm and then we're saying harm, I could see how it could be read, even though we've had this conversation, that it wouldn't have to reach the bar of being serious. So that will be something that I will note, and if I find out serious harm is used elsewhere, I will seek to amend this in the Judiciary Committee, and I don't think I'd have a problem, you know, getting support for that, because we definitely would – we're talking about it. We believe it's implied, but we want to make sure. So we will add it.
Is there
I will attempt to add it. I can't promise.
Is there a motion to amendment for Amendment 25, Senator Reinbold? All right, I'll object. We'll do a roll call vote.
No.
No.
No. Yes.
No. With one yay and four nays, Amendment 25 fails. Brings us to Amendment 26. Senator Reinbold.
I move Amendment number 26.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So basically, this one really focuses on, first of all, line 1, page 3, situation relating to the administrative psychotropic drugs. Again, this goes into a new section where it says, before administering the psychotropic drugs, a minor or patient under the section or a mental health professional shall consult with a parent, guardian, or other family members to evaluate the minor for drug withdrawal, medical psychosis caused by currently prescribed medications or self-medication. Could be drugs or anything, and use and review the medical history, diet modification, and triggers and other contributing factors. So once again, you guys know that I'm extreme cautious in regards to psychotropic medications. This just puts parents in charge in regards to this type of a situation, that they just need to consult with it. It doesn't say you have to get informed consent. It doesn't have to say. It just says that they will consult with a parent and trying to find out if there's any other triggers that are going on before they do administer these psychotropic drugs.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Baggage.
Thank you. You know, we had an extensive discussion on at least the first part of this about the whole issue of safety and whether or not a person who might be consulted is somebody, A, that has the best interests of the patient in mind, or B, could be the cause of the episode, C, might themselves potentially not have the patients, the patient might not have given them the clearance to discuss their medical conditions. So I think there are issues with HIPAA here. There are issues with potentially abuse or dealing with abuse. I know that is not the intent of the maker, but I simply don't think that this works. And we've discussed it extensively. I think it was amendment, I want to say it was either 12, 13, or 14, somewhere in there. And so I would not be supporting this amendment.
Further discussion on amendment 26.
Quick comment. Is there a wrap-up? We can do a wrap-up for all
I
can.
I do a quick comment.
Okay, quick comment.
Because those those, there were a couple amendments that I said I would take forward to make sure we're not bringing someone who's abusive into it so we can get that consent. Mm-hmm. So I am planning to work on that in judiciary and just want to get that on the record.
All right. Senator Casella, then Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. So I support the intention of this amendment. When I look at where it's placed, which is AS 473836, it relates to psychotropic medication in non-crisis situations, and the statute has no A. So this is inserting B. So I'm in support of this amendment, but I believe it's drafted incorrectly. I think it should be the number 4. I'm going to vote for it, and then if there's conforming changes that need to be made by the drafters as it moves to the next committee, I do think there's an error here.
Thank you, Senator Casella. Senator Reinbold, with your wrap-up.
Okay, so I'm not sure if there's an A somewhere else. So so thank you for pointing that out. No, I'm talking about on the bill somewhere. I'm just not sure. Excellent point. I'm just saying the drafter did, Dunmire did this. But I do think it's very, very important. It just says you shall consult with a parent or a guardian or another family member of the minor. So it's just an advocate, basically, for the minor. I think it's really, really important. Psychotropic drugs can do horrible things to people, and there can be tremendous side effects, and this is a consult. It's just a simple consult to make sure that they understand a little bit more about the patient before they take such an extreme step. So with that, I urge a yes vote. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. With that, we'll go to a roll call vote for Amendment 26.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
No.
No. 3 ayes and 2 nays. Amendment 26 passes. Bring us to amendment number 27.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 27.
I'll object. Senator Reinbold.
So basically what this says is on page 1, line 9, instead of believes in good faith, this actually says observes. So I just think it's very, very important not to just have someone just randomly believe something. I actually think they need to observe something that is of concern and document it. And then on page 1, line 10, it says according to standards and measurements. So I just think that there needs to be just not a random thought or a random accusation, oftentimes false accusation. In many cases, you'll see the court filled with a lot of people that have made accusations and they're not substantiated. But anyway, this just says, it's rather than believes in good faith, observes, and once again, according to standards and measurements. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I think this is something that Mr. Morgan would like to speak to. He came up here, and I was going to come and ask him about how DPS implements this. So is this something that you guys currently do? I mean, how do you, observe in good faith?
Well, through the chair again, Leon Morgan, Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Public Safety. Just in response to the amendment, I would point the group to Section A, which as it states, as an alternative to arrest, as the predicating action for anything we do here. So we have already determined in any of these cases that the subject that we're involved with has committed a crime. At least we've determined probable cause to believe that person has committed a crime. So we've already done an assessment of the situation to where we could either arrest them or cite them for a criminal offense. And it is then that we are observing in good faith. And good faith is a legal standard that we are held accountable to in lots of different judicatory proceedings, including search warrant applications and executions. So we wouldn't be willy-nilly just finding somebody and making an observation. If you read what's right before that, it's as an alternative to arrest, the arresting officer. So we have already made the determination that we can arrest this person and take them to jail based on our observations and the probable cause therein. So that is the that's the underlying situation on any of the cases that we're going to be involved in.
All right. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so I appreciate you, and you know I trust you. You're a constituent. All fairness, I have tremendous respect for you. It just says, and I'm really thankful you just put that on the record because you said as an alternative to arrest. And so you basically just stated on record this person has committed a crime, and it sounds like what I'm hoping I'm not reading too much into this, but it's saying rather than putting them in jail or whatever, which we've talked about over and over again, this person is basically a violent criminal. I mean, for all, you know, either to herself or other, you have an opportunity to arrest them, but instead of doing that, this is without charges. They said the arresting officer believes in good faith that the person is suffering from an acute behavioral crisis. What I just wanted to say observes, you know, under the standards and measurements. So they actually have done something pretty serious. It could be you could charge them, you just said. And that's kind of a big deal to me in this bill. And it actually would provide me with more support for the bill if that's exactly what the intention of the bill is. So that's really important.
Through the chair, Senator Rambold, I'm just reading from the bill. Yeah, as an alternative to arrest, the peace officer may, and then when you look at subsection 1, the arresting officer. So we're referring to the situation as an arrest, which the predicate action, their predicate reasoning there is probable cause that a crime has been committed and we can arrest in that situation. I would, again, with great respect, offer some differing language to violent criminal. We will run into people who necessarily aren't violent criminals that are committing crimes that might cause them to be arrested, that would be arrested, but would be good candidates for a diversion into a crisis stabilization center.
Thank you, sir. Any closing remarks?
Well, I just wanted to ask the question of what does standards and measurements mean to you, Deputy Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, there is no, in my world, there is no measurements and standards, standard in this. When I think we're saying the arresting officer believes in good faith, and that's the core statement there. We see good faith repeated a lot in how officers take action in performance of their duties. So that is the legal standard. But again, what's already happened is we've determined that probable cause exists, that a crime has occurred, and we are in good faith recognizing that this person has is having a mental episode that would better serve them to be diverted into a crisis stabilization center. In terms of the language proposed, I don't have any comment on that other than just it's not really consistent with any of the other standards that we go by.
All right. Senator Hughes and Senator Reinbold, and then we're going to take a vote and move on to our adjournment of this meeting.
Thank you. Officer, I believe I heard you say that the believes in good faith is used elsewhere, and it involves in observing, because you kind of have to observe before you can believe something. So would you agree that the believes in good faith includes observation?
To the chair, Senator Hughes, yes.
And then could you just, so we understand, because if we get rid of believes in good faith and we just do observes, we might be leaving something out. So if believes in good faith includes observation, what else does it include?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the good faith standard is basically applied. It's a reasonableness standard. So it's applied to all officers' action based on what they are doing, right? What's your predicate action and how are you performing your duties? And are you basing that on the reasonableness standard, acting in good faith of what another officer would be doing? Where we automatically make observations is through our assessment of probable cause. And in this case, again, if we are going to arrest somebody, again, that's the predicate action here. In lieu of an arrest, we are taking them to a crisis stabilization center. In order to determine probable cause, you have to have observation. You can't have one or the other. So I observe actions that lead me to develop probable cause that this person should be arrested. And I could either take them to jail, or with this new bill, I could, if I'm acting in good faith and I'm making these observations that the person is having a psychotic break and potentially doesn't have the mens rea necessary for belief or, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the criminal case, I could take them to a crisis stabilization center. And as long as I'm doing that in good faith, I'm making those observations based on my training and my experience as a law enforcement officer in this state.
Thank you, and I think it's great that you got on the record that it doesn't, include observation.
All right, Senator Reinbold, closing remarks for amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think it's really important because how the bill reads doesn't say probable cause to believe that they've committed a crime. That's completely missing. So if you actually arrest someone, they know their charges, they know their rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is a totally different situation. It says it's an alternative to arrest a peace officer at the officer's discretion, can deliver a person to a crisis stable center, a crisis residence center, or an evaluation facility, or decline to arrest a person if they believe in good faith that the person is suffering from an acute health crisis, and then the person volunteers, and it goes on and on and on. The thing that is it's hard for me to understand is officer's discretion and good faith. And I think what you reiterated even more, did you say yes or no that good faith is actually in statute, or is it just a standard that you guys have posted somewhere?
It's a criminal standard, through the chair, Senator Reinbold. It's a criminal standard applied to us by the courts.
Okay, so through the chair. It's from the courts? Is that what I'm hearing? It's not written in statute.
Good faith, through the chair, Senator Reinbold. Good faith is a standard that's applied to actions that we take and is adjudicated by courts. That's the courts are the ones who determine either are our actions reasonable or are we acting in good faith. That is a decision that is made by our court system.
All right, Senator Rambo.
Okay, with that, I'm gonna keep the amendment because everything you said, we actually get to put it into statute. There's actually something observed, and there's actually some standards and measurements, put into place for something because this is, if they're not arrested and they're just taken away and they're losing a tremendous amount of rights, when this happens, I'm just trying to get it as clear as I can and as many protections as we can put on rather than just the officer believes. So with that, with all due respect, but I really appreciate it. I'm so glad you came because you got some super important things on the record that I think are very, very valid. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. With that, we'll take a vote on Amendment 27.
No. Yes.
Nope.
No.
No. With one yay and four nays, amendment number 27 fails. At this time, we'll set Senate Bill 124 aside. And on our next committee meeting on Thursday, we will consider amendments to SB 175, Healthcare Services by Telehealth. We'll also hear initial presentation on HB 184 to require Tribal Child Compact Welfare Compact. And if possible, if time allows, we will continue the amendment process to Senate Bill 124. That concludes our business today, thanks everyone for attending. It is 3:07.